Well, ladies and gentlemen, for our history segment today, I am honored to have a special guest join us. Sitting here with Steve Snyder, and he is, among many other things, he is the president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association, and he's the author of a book called Shot Down, which we're going to dive deep into today because it's about the sacrifices and heroic activities that laid out that his father, among other veterans, achieved during their time in the service. So, Mr. Schneider, thank you again for joining us today. Staying cool out there in the out west there.
Well, thank you. Yes, I'm happy to be on the show. It's I'm at our we have two homes that go back and forth between Seal Beach, California, which is about 40 miles south of LA, and then Sedona, Arizona, where my wife and I are in Sedona, Arizona right now. So it's pretty warm here. It's in the 90s, but
And then
we
a
got air
rare.
conditioning, so it's okay.
Yeah, it's a rare coincidence because it's a little warm this week as well in Buffalo, which you don't hear too much about Buffalo, New York. But thank you for joining us. And I have to say, I'm an avid reader besides my daily work that is a lot of reading. I always enjoy wonderful stories of veterans, of course, in history. The way you wrote this book is just phenomenal. I enjoyed it. I actually read it just this past Father's Day. It's how I spent a big bulk of my Father's Day. And it was wonderful because it's a tribute to your father, of course, but you didn't exclude, it wasn't just about your father's service, it was about all the folks that had a hand in the achievements and the sacrifices of that campaign. So if I could, let's start a little bit for our listeners that maybe aren't familiar with the story yet, although I'm going to encourage them to pick up a copy of the book. Would you tell us a little bit about your father's background? What home life was prior to service, and then how that started off for him, joining the
Okay.
service.
My dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska. He moved to California with his family right before he started high school, Glendale High School. And then he met my mother through Waltherly, which was the Lutheran, church, Missouri Synod youth group. And after high school, he actually went to work. He would work for Desmond's Clothing Company. Local chain in the Los Angeles County area. And then in the fall of 1940, when President Roosevelt implemented the first peacetime draft in history, my dad went into the service in April of 1941. And my mother went later in July. And then he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. To begin with, he went into the Army, the infantry, didn't go right into the Air Force. And he was stationed in Fort Lewis, Washington. And then later that year, on December 7th, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States was at war. My mother was very scared, and the future was very uncertain. So she decided to go to Washington over Christmas and visit my dad. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born, my oldest sister. That's when he decided to go into the Air Force, as he didn't think he could provide for his family very well on a private's pay in the Army. So in June of 42, he started pilot training, and we can talk about that. But my dad was, and I had a great relationship with my dad. He was a no-nonsense guy. My sisters and I always compared him to John Wayne. He was a big guy, 6'3", rugged guy. Things were black and white, had strong principles. He was a strong Christian. And he was my little league coach. And so we were very close. He would take me fishing because grew up, in Nebraska as a kid and liked to fish and hunt. And we'd go up in the mountains. I never hunted, not much hunting in Southern California.
Right. So.
So, we had a great relationship. I had his older sisters, Susan and Nancy.
And I love how I don't want to spoil too many things of the book here. I really want listeners to pick up a copy. It's just so much rich history, and just the way you wrote that is wonderful. But I love how, later on, of course, he gets to name his plane.
Yeah, he was the first pilot, so as a result, he was the commander of the plane and the crew. B-17 had a 10-man crew, there were four officers and then six enlisted men. Three of the officers were married, but my dad was the only member of the crew who had a child. So they ended up naming the plane the Susan Ruth, after my oldest sister,
Yeah.
Susan Ruth Snyder.
Yep. I love that. And you mentioned your father's faith. That reads throughout the book in many different ways. I really enjoyed some of the mentions. I mean, he even forgive me, I'm forgetting the gentleman's name. Mother met Joe Musio, but there was
Joe
a
Musial.
Musio. I apologize. Yeah. There's a one gentleman that, didn't really have faith, and your father, talked to him and even wrote a letter to your mother about, oh, there's this fellow that's, so I feel like I'd gotten to know your father through this book. It's just extremely well written, and you can tell how he carried himself. And like you just said, there's a right and a wrong, and he was always going for the right. So that's
Yeah, but one of the things that was inspired me to write the book were all the letters that my dad wrote to my mother while he was stationed in England, which he kept before he was shot down. And unlike most guys who wrote back home, my dad was really candid in those letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the air base at the 306 bomb group that he was in, what life was like in London and England at the time, and escapades of him and his crew. And so there was so much information in those letters,
Yeah.
and I kind of started, just wrote the book on a chronological order as his letters, because it was just rich with information. And like he said, there's one time he wrote where they got in this big discussion about religion, and he couldn't believe that actually it was their a navigator who was a atheist. And it just, my dad was beside himself that this guy could not believe that he taught.
Yeah, I love that. I love how you included the letters, because it just added so much to it. Yeah, he there was a line or two there where he said, we've been talking for hours. I can't believe it. It's almost midnight. Okay, I gotta go. He's venting to your mother. I love that. And he referenced when he was trying to purchase her some Christmas gifts, I believe, that he
Yeah, some chinaware or Wedgwood, or he was really detailed. And so, most letters that those guys wrote just said, "I'm fine, the weather's lousy, the food stinks," and that was about it. My dad, he censored his crew's letters, and then his commanding officer of the 306 bomb group censored his letters. But my dad got preferential treatment from his CO because he was the cap or the center on the basketball team, and the CO was the captain of the basketball team, and they won the base championship. Okay. The CO gave my dad a lot of leeway, and my dad said that sometimes he thought the commanding officer was more interested in the basketball games than he was in the combat bombing missions. And so I think that's why my dad's letters didn't get censored, and his CO kind of let them pass through, and that's why they're so rich with information.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful writing style. No wonder you became an author as a result there with the it's
Oh,
in the
that was,
genetics.
I was never, I never, it wasn't my profession. I had a 40-year career in sales and sales management, so I had
I
no.
know, but you can see that you just naturally, that's in your genes there, sir. You somehow had that the whole time.
Yeah, I guess so. And when I told my friends I was writing a book, and they thought, "What? You're writing a book?" We just kind of laughed at me, like, this is going to be a farce. But had to eat their words, it turned out to be.
Yeah, I would say this is required reading for military academies and then some. I mean, there's so much context there. So we could probably talk all day about some of these aspects. It's just such an enjoyable story, but of course, eventually it gets into a serious topic, right?
Right.
So if you could, because I guess what I was blown away with, like you said, your father was writing these letters all along. So even as things get more and more serious, but I guess walk us through whatever level you're comfortable with now about, when the war started, how that impacted things and this entire crew, some of the statistics you read through Holy cow, it blew my mind. I consider myself well versed in certain things in military history, but what these crews went through and the amount of just in the training alone, and then of course in combat, the statistics were really, really grim, and there was a demoralization effort, impact there to the crew. But walk us through some of those high points of the war started, how things went, and then of course the ultimate impact to your father and his flight there.
Okay. The 306 Bomb Group was one of about 40 bomb groups that were in the 8th Air Force, and 8th Air Force arrived in England in the around August, a little before August of 1942. Their first mission was on 17th of 1942, and in the early years of the war, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. At the beginning of the air war, the 8th Bomber Command thought that these heavily armed bombers, they had about, around B-17. My dad flew a B-17. The 306 Bomb Group flew B-17s. They were nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of their armament. They had a plane. They had 13 50-caliber machine guns, a tremendous amount of firepower. So they thought there was all this firepower and these bombers flying formations that they could ward off the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, and they didn't need fighter escort. Sadly, that was not the case. And even when they did give them fighter escorts, the fighters at that time and early in the air war didn't have the fuel capacity to escort them all the way deep into Germany. They could go across the English Channel into France a little ways, but then they'd have to turn around back to their bases because they'd be running low on fuel. And the losses really culminated in 1943. Even though they had implemented a mission limit of 25 in April of 43, so hit 25 missions, we go home. It was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions in 1943. The average number of missions flown was only six. There were 26,000 men that died in the 8th Air Force, more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific, and another 20,000 men became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the cab either in an aircraft fire. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most d dangerous duty assignment in the United States military. And it was my dad arrived in his crew at the 306 Bomb Group on October 21st. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed, because they had all these hundreds of planes were taken off from these bases all at the same time. And a lot of times the weather was bad and they couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So midair collisions occurred. And then they had to deal with enemy fighters because Germany had radar stations set up along the continental coast of England and had sent up their Luftwaffe to intercept the bombers. And they would have anti-aircraft fire. From these flak guns with fire. They were deadly weapons. They fired 20 shells a minute, and these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal that would burst out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombs. And then once they hit the bomb the target, they had to try to form back up, and once again they'd face enemy fighters going back to their bases. And once they got to England, they could have dead or injured pilots. Their planes could be have severe battle damage, running low on fuel, and crash landings were common, and more airmen lost their lives. Yeah, flying combat was unbelievable. But on February 8th of 1944, my dad and his crew went on a mission to Frankfurt, Germany, and they released their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by flak, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag in the plane. They lost airspeed behind the bomber formation heading back to their bases in England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, like wolves or lions, coming down on prey, swept in and for the kill. And the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth shot down. But both those Focke-Wulf 190 fighters shot down as well. It was piloted by Siegfried Merritt, killed in the plane. The other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and made it through the war. And this is a fascinating part of my research. All my dad knew and all the Air Force knew was that my dad's plane was attacked by German Focke-Wulf fighters, and that's all I thought I'd ever know. Yeah, but one day my wife Glenda said, "Well, why don't you try to find the German fighter pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" And I'm thinking, "Oh, she's pretty naive, she doesn't know what she's talking about. It'd be impossible." But like a good husband, I did what I told me to do, and I found Hans Berger,
It's
and
amazing.
fortunately for me, became a translator after the war, and I spoke perfect English. He gave me wonderful information that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the Air Force, 8th Air Force. And then I learned from Hans that the gunners on my dad's plane shot him down at the same time he shot my dad down. They shot each other down. And we became friends. So that was, I can't tell you how excited I was to find him and just ask him, just bombarded him with questions.
Yeah, it's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
So, as you mentioned earlier, the book's just not about my dad, but it goes into detail. Well, the first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happened afterwards. And the book goes into detail about what happened to each of dad's 10 crew, but also about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives able to bail out. So it talks a lot about the underground and the resistance. And helping these guys avoid capture, German secret police, the Gestapo. I'll talk a little bit about my dad. People have to read the book to find out about the other human, because we really don't have time to go and happen to each one of those. But I will say that five members of my dad's crew made it home, but five did not. Fortunately for me, my dad was one of the five, or else I wouldn't be here. But after he bailed out, he came down in some trees right at the French-Belgian border, and his parachute got hung up in the branches, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground, and he couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian men, Henri Frank and Henri Montauban, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. It happened early in the afternoon. They told him to help him down from the told him to hide, and then they'd come back at nighttime. Get him because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during daylight. So that night they came back and got him, took him to the Durban farmhouse. He only stayed there one night because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay any there any longer than that, again with those German patrols in the area. And then the next night, Belgian customs and a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. And after that, he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He spent one night in 6 weeks. And the Belgian people who hid my dad, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but their lives, family, and friends. Because of the Gestapo found out about, they'd be arrested, tortured, shot, or sent to a concentration camp. Some of the Belgian people who helped my dad and didn't meet that fate. Most books about the air over Europe, just talk to mainly talk about bombing missions, and then some of them talk about guys that were shot down to become prisoners of war. But very few talk about what happens on the ground after these guys. Missing in action months on time interaction underground or the distance to a
Yeah, there's one part that sticks out in my mind is you wrote it in such a way it's like I was there watching this scene unfold. But there's a German patrol unit coming towards one of the houses that he was staying in at one point. He probably jumped out of the window, went into the woods for a bit, if I remember that correctly.
Yeah. There's a number of instances described in the book where my dad was almost discovered.
And the family tried to protect him even in that situation. I mean, just to your point, I mean, we kind of overlook those details in war sometimes,
Oh yeah. I mean, my dad, the people he stayed with for lengthy periods of time, stayed in touch with until they died. Corresponded, went over to Belgium. He thought they saved his life. They would let him sleep in their bed. They'd sleep on the floor. All the food was rationed back then by the Nazis, and so, but they'd give him, larger portions. They were just unbelievable people. But hiding was really stressful, not only because, my dad almost got discovered a few times, but his plane's, attacked, it's on fire, he has to bail out, he comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the US military, and he's being helped by complete strangers who they can't communicate. My dad has a little French English dictionary he could refer to, but that was about it. That's the way he learned French. One of the places he were hidden, young 16-year-old girl, Mimi Gabriel, could speak English, and she'd play cards and Monopoly and crossword puzzles and teach my dad, taught my dad speak conversation with friends. Any of these people that helped my dad could be a collaborator, rat him out to the Nazis. But finally, he got tired of hiding. Word came on June 6th that Allies had invaded Normandy. He decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, my dad had that year's experience in the army,
Right.
training in the infantry. He knew how to fight on the ground. And he convinced one of his helpers, Amy Gules, to escort him across the border into France through a bike. Tried to talk him out of it because, he was risking his life fighting the Nazis. He'd either be shot or killed in the fighting, or if they captured him, they would have shot him on the spot as a terrorist. But he thought it was his duty to get back in the fight. The Americans were fighting and dying. He thought, he should be back in the fight, even though the safest thing to do, the logical thing to do was have been just to stay hunkered down and in hiding until the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day to liberate the area. But he joined a unit of the French resistance. They were called the Mackie. They were small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups all across France, and they harassed the Germans. They would attack convoys, sabotage railway lines, disrupt communications, assassinate German officers. They got their instructions from the British through coded messages over the BBC, and they would be supplied by airdrops from the British. That said, if they told told them that there was a German convoy coming down this road at this day at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and everything. Nazis were up.
Yeah, it's
And then
incredible.
there are several encounters that are described in the book that the Mackie group had with my dad, their group, that were
Yeah,
pretty familiar.
significant achievements by that group. I mean, if it wasn't for your dad as an individual going out there with his experience, I mean that's there again. I mean, he was fighting from up high and on the ground. I mean, it's just an incredible journey.
And then finally, 7 months after he bailed out on, or approximately 7 months, on September 2nd, word came in that there were U.S. troops in the nearby village of Treslong, France. Went into town, walked up to a major, actually with an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up France after D-Day, and identified himself. Then he got a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, and then hopped on a transport from Paris back to England, where he sent a Union telegram, a Western Union telegram, to my mother saying, at the base, it is a fiddle. He'd write soon. That ended his 7 month experience of missing in action and either being hidden by numerous Belgian people or fighting with the resistance. It was
Could I ask what, if you know, could I ask what that was like to get that type of telegram? Because we all know the stories of the other telegrams, but I mean, for your mother, did she ever share, or was there any comments about what that out of the blue notice was like for her?
Yeah, well, to begin with, they were shot down February 8th, and she received the Western Union telegram, or well, all the families, whether wives or mothers. That they were shot down and missing in action. That program came on February 23rd. Then my other sister, Nancy, was born on April 28th. So she was born while my dad was missing in action. Here's
Wow.
my mom with a 1-year-old, girl, Susan, and then an infant, Nancy. And not knowing if she's going to see her husband ever again. Another really poignant and personal part of the book is after the plane was shot down, and then those families received those telegrams, excerpts and letters they exchanged between one another, worried, sick, and praying that their loved one, under their son or their sweetheart, turn. Those were very moving. And there, some of the men were captured and became prisoners of war. They were able to write home, so they knew what happened to some of the crew. My mother didn't know anything. That Western Union telegram. It's around, September 8th, and talk about a joyous day, from a mother and my dad's folks, all the relatives. What a relief. I mean, I can't even imagine the joy must have.
Yeah, I can only imagine the initial fear and then joy, because you're getting another Western Union message, and then she's realizing it's from him instead of the
Right.
government. I can only imagine that roller coaster in the mind, and it happened in a millisecond. The first two
Yeah.
words or so completely reversed probably what she expected that was going to be. So that's incredible. And then, as far as you recollect, what was the early days and years? I know a lot of activity happened later, but how was the initial adjustment home for him and your family as a whole?
Well, they sent my dad back to the States for the remainder of the war. Became a P-17 flight instructor. Air Force had a rule at that time that if you were shot down and aided by the underground, you couldn't go back into combat. They thought if you went back and were shot down a second time, and this time captured by the Germans and tortured, that you might give up the identity of the people they helped the first time. The only exception to that rule that I'm aware of is Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower. Talked Eisenhower to letting them go on that. It was a huge adjustment for my dad. Here he comes home. He's here suffering from PTSD at the time. He's on the pins and needles constantly when hiding. Because he could be discovered at any time and become a POW, and then fighting against the Nazis for a months. So my parents had some rough months. One of my aunts told me about it. They had some tough times. My dad was trying to, decompress all that, but then he has these two little, girls who are, demanding time, and so he wasn't ready really for that. Wanted to get back to his wife because they didn't have much time together as newlyweds. And so he wanted to spend time with her, and that was kind of tough. And my mother told me one night that my dad was having these nightmares, and he started choking my mother, and she's yelling, "Howard, Howard!" And, so it was definitely affected by it. I never witnessed any of that. I was born, 2 years after the war, so he had gotten over that, and but it just anecdotal stories that I was told.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that it's somewhat of a common trend there, but thank God your mother handled it, and should be praised for what she did to help him settle. Yeah, going from a young, barely married fella to all of that, and then come back, you have two kids on top of that. It's a lot to adjust, and it's understandable.
So, like most World War II veterans, my dad, didn't talk a lot about it while I was growing up. I knew all the basics. I knew he was shot down, he was missing in action, and fought with the resistance and like that. But in 1989, they erected a memorial to my dad, who in the village of Mackinac, Belgium, which is just north of the French border. right near where my plane came. And my dad went over for the dedication. Three other members of the crew that were still living at the time, and there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him and revisited these places where he was hidden. That brought it all back, and he started talking about it. And then 5 years later, made my first trip to Belgium. Been over there six times, so I went over with my parents, and that's when it became personal for me because my dad took me around and I saw all these places, met one of its helpers. I'm going back for a seventh time this fall for the to attend the 80th anniversary celebrations of the liberation of Belgium and ceremonies. Actually, with three memorials to either members of my crew or other downed airmen that are in the shot down story in Belgium. They're wonderful events. All the local villagers come out. You know that they have these set up these huge tents where they have all these dinners and band concerts and dinners and the U.S. military is represented, Belgian military, French military, the U.S. ambassador to Belgium, now with an entourage, and several ceremonies that are, you know, there's the tent ceremonies are very fun. You know, the local beer champagne just flows. But, you know, they have ceremonies that are solemn at various memorials in the area, which are very moving. So I'm looking forward to going back over. I'd hope to continue on from Belgium to visit Hans Berger, the Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane. But unfortunately, he died this past January at age 100. So I'm not going to be able to. As I mentioned earlier, we became friends, and I did go to visit him in Munich, Germany, a couple times. Wonderful. So I
I bet your father would be incredibly impressed with that piece of your journey of when you reached out to him.
Yeah, when during my research, you know, I found relatives of not a I found relatives of all his crew to ask them if they could give me, you know, any information, you know, and a couple of them written little short diaries or accounts. And then I discovered ancestors of Belgium helpers who had been told stories about my dad, you know. So I actually know more about what happened to my dad and his crew than my dad did.
That's what I'm thinking. I bet he would be just blown away by your research. And I only speak for myself. I know every veteran has their own views, but I mean, I think about 40, 50 years out from it's been 20 years for me since my time in the service, and I think, well, geez, you watch some of these incredible things that have happened over the years where World War II vets go back to where. Whether it be the beach of Normandy, for example, for the D-Day that they just had this year for 80th anniversary, like, geez, would I go back and see where our campaign was? And I think part of me says, yeah, probably, but I don't know that I would, necessarily knock on the door and want to sit down and have a meal with some folks that were on the other side. Although, as I'll just say this as myself, in my own opinion, is it's like I understand that. Soldiers don't start wars. We have something in common of serving others. It's just a theme that whether it was forced upon us at a young age or we grew into it on our own or the military gave us that feeling. So I have sat with people from other military other countries that serve their country and we can appreciate the fact that we were put into a campaign because of politics or what have you, but there's probably more in common with two service members from other sides of a battleground than you'll ever get from, let's say, two presidents of those countries.
Right.
So
Yeah.
that's a really interesting connection that you made, developed, and like you said, well, you were listening to your wife, you took that tip and you went with
Yeah. It's, you know,
So.
everyone, I think, like you're alluding to, you know, has a different view because, you know, I know guys that whose dads were killed in the 8th Air Force, and they, I mean, they can't understand how I became friends with Hans Berger.
Right.
They
No,
just know.
I
They
totally
just
understand all the
wait a minute.
viewpoints on that, but I think part of me wants to reflect upon, history as a whole and to put myself out of the equation and just see that type of connection we've made and go, wow, that's really something.
And each conflict or war is different, and each person's experiences, are different. And the interaction with the enemy is different. So I can see how, the thoughts would vary a lot. But the way I looked at it, Hans was just a young guy, 19, 20 years old, fighting for his country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. Like Hans said, it's too bad that they were shooting, had to shoot it at each other, but that was war. Said we weren't all evil Nazis. And the World War II was a defining moment of my dad's life. There's nothing that could compare to that. Hot down and fighting with the resistance. So at one point in time, my dad's life crossed paths with Hans. So Hans, part of my dad's story, a part of his life. So, I felt a kinship with him. Not that other, my dad survived. That makes a difference
Absolutely.
too. There's just a lot of factors that
Yeah,
are
no,
involved.
absolutely. That's all understood. But I just want to congratulate you on taking that effort because it really does add a level of viewpoints in history to this book. And I think your dad would have found that fascinating.
Yeah, that would have been great if the two of them could have met. I would have
Yeah.
loved to, just sat in a corner and listen to them, talk about it,
Yeah.
air war over Europe.
Well, like I said, the book, I can't speak highly enough. So folks, you definitely want to pick up a copy of this. But if we could, before wrapping up, I'm really curious about the association itself. And maybe we could talk about if there's a website or something that maybe people that want to support what you're doing for the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association. Could we talk about that for a couple minutes?
Sure. As you said, I'm president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association. And we have a website. It's 306. Oh, gosh.
That's okay. I'll put the link. Yeah, folks, I'll have the link on the site for today's show. So we'll have
Yeah.
the
If
link
you
there
just
for you.
Google 306
Yep.
Bomb Group Historical Association,
Yeah, I'll put that on there.
that on there. But we have a reunion every year. We have put out a newsletter twice a year. We have a great website with probably one of the best research websites of any bomb group is you can look up all the men who served in the 306 Bomb Group, mission reports and all sorts of documents and records, find out about any vet in the 306 Bomb Group. Actually, the 306 Bomb Group has a now is represented at the Air Force Academy, U.S. Air Force Academy, the 306 Flying Training Group is the kind of the extended group of the 306. But our website's very robust. We have a Facebook page where there's lots of information. We post a newsletter twice a year, and then we have a reunion. I'm also on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society, it puts on a reunion every year. This year it's in New Orleans at the Higgins Hotel, right across the street from the World War II National Museum. They're wonderful events. We have tours and speakers and that. So I'm heavily involved with both organizations, and also writing the book changed my life. I have this really a second career all around the United States. Doing the PowerPoint presentations to all sorts of groups, going to air show and signing copies of my book, and really become a, like I say, a second career, and if not a full-time job, at least so rewarding, because I'm trying to keep the memory of these guys alive. And writing the book, I was a tribute to my dad, a tribute to his crew, but also a tribute to all the men who fought in the 8th Air Force and really everyone who fought in World War II. And World War II is fading in the past. It's 80 years ago. Well, next year it'll be 80 years ago that the World War II ended, and it's fading in people's memories. And organizations like the 306 Bomb Group Association, Association, the 8th Air Force, trying to keep that memory alive.
Yeah, well, you're doing a fantastic job, sir, doing that. I got to tell you, I'm very grateful for everything you and your family's doing because this is a big factor of why I host the show. I volunteer. This is not a job for me. This is just something that I think is warranted to share stories like this. To your point, 80 year, we're 80 plus years away from these what would have been news stories. And there's a couple generations of folks that know very little about any of it.
Right,
And
unfortunately.
yeah, it's a real shame because we, not that you want to dwell on horrific stories. You don't have to dwell on the horrifics of it, but you need to dive deep on the lessons that came out of it, or we're just going to repeat all the horrors of it. I mean, that's just how nature and history works. So what you're working on is important, because every veteran has their story, but if we're not sharing that and people aren't learning from it, then it's almost like they went through all of that for nothing. We have to draw from that. So I'll just say I'm honored for your time today, but I'm very proud of what you're doing, for not just your dad and his crew and fellow friends there, but all service members, because these are the types of books, like I said earlier, I mean, this really should be required reading. This is U.S. history. There's just so much to get out of there. Now I do want to say one fun thing that escaped me a few moments ago with the 306. I know we talked about this a little bit, but it was through you that I learned the origin of the number 306 and how that came about. And that's a personal connection to me. Would you mind sharing that detail? And then I'll chime in with my fun comment.
Yeah, well, actually, in each bomb group, there's four bomb squadrons. So in the 306 bomb group, my dad was in the 369th
There you go.
bomb squadron, nicknamed Fightin' Bightin'. So, and I doing my research and writing the book is it from the time I started writing my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. I found out that it was based on the Fighting 69th from. It was the Civil War.
Yeah, New York, yeah.
Yeah, the New York Regiment.
Yeah, and I never knew that, and I should have, because that's who I fought, and that's who I served with. It was the 69th Infantry out of New York. So I'm upstate New York, Buffalo. I was in the National Guard at the time, attached to the 69th. And yes, they have a proud history going back to the Civil War days, World War II. And I'll just chime in this fun little nugget in case you don't know the story. So the movie and the book Fighting 69th was about the World War II group, because they fought.
For World War One or World War Two?
Oh, forgive me. So
World
first,
War One.
yeah. And
Yeah.
then, yeah. So, but the origin story of why they call them the Fighting 69th, it's not that they're a bunch of rough and tumble guys. The history goes back because they were opposing forces to the New Orleans Brigade, the 256 Infantry in New Orleans. And, they fought each other during the Civil War. And then World War I comes about, and the training and so on that they have to do to get to know each other to go off to battle. And that goes on for a while. I can prove that in a moment. But initially, it was a training of the World War I days. They have to work together. Well, that means that they're fighting with, on the same team, people in their family fought against in battle. You see, there's some old grudges that played out in the training camps, and then they say, oh, we're these boys, it's all men back then. Oh, these fighting 69th boys, always getting in trouble. So that goes on. They wind up being this incredible force once they get over their past grievances, we'll say. And you would think after the World War, you would think that the Army would take note of that and say, hey, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't have them train together anymore. Maybe. But I'll tell you what, when I went over, I was with the 256 from New Orleans. So you
That's
literally have Civil War, World Wars, everything since, including the Iraq campaign of 2004. That's who we served together with. And some
well,
of my
funny.
nearest and dearest friends are from both of those units. And it's funny because they all know that history, but I never knew, and I don't think they'll know until they listen to the show today, or they watch the replay online, that your father served with the 369th, which was from the 69th Infantry Army. And I love the fact that your dad spent some time with the Army as well. It's just a wonderful, it ties it all together,
Yeah, right.
So I just can't thank you enough for your research, your wonderful writing style of this. Like I said, I enjoyed it myself, just sitting in the backyard, enjoying Father's Day. And it was very fitting to do that, to read a book about your father. So I just want to thank you again and honor your father's service and thank you for what you and your family's doing to preserve this history.
Well, I appreciate it very much, and I enjoyed being on your show. I thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as I mentioned, I was sitting here, wonderful talk with Steve Snyder. I want you to check out his book. Pick up a copy. Just go to his website directly. And who knows, maybe you'll get an autographed copy that way. But Steve Snyder, that's Snyder, author.com. And if you lost that, just go to our site. I'll have all the links underneath this gentleman's biography, so you can pick up a copy. And check out this association. I want you to go to that website as well. Maybe show some support. And in the meantime, you at least learn some incredible history, like you did today. So I'm going to have a quick musical break, and then we'll be right back for some other comments. Stand by.